This is the Bald Scientist Podcast, where we talk about science, from the factual to the fictional, and sometimes a bit of both, with the good doctor, One R. Pagan.
Well, hello and welcome to episode 5 of the Bald Scientist Podcast. This is, of course, One, your host, wishing each and every one of you and yours merry everything and happy everything. I thank you all for your patience on waiting for this episode, but things do work for the best. You see, this episode will see the light of day on a very special day, December the 30th. My birthday. Yes. Today I'm 56 years old. In fact, my birth date is December the 30th, 1964. Yes, I am a boomer for 2 freaking days. If my dear mom would have held on to me for just 2 more days, I wouldn't be a boomer. But that's all right. Up until a few years ago, I used to tell the obligatory joke about getting older. Oh, I'm turning 40. Oh, I'm turning 45. And I would, quote-unquote, lament the passage of time. But truth be told, I was only partially joking. A small part of me got a little, you know, not annoyed, concerned that I was getting older. After a certain point in my life, that's not the case anymore. I'm embracing this. I'm loving this. I'm very happy because I get to be 56 today. You see, especially this year, it's very acutely apparent that a lot of people don't get to live that long, not even close. And yet, life, God, the universe, gives me the privilege of staying around. And I intend to enjoy every single minute of it. And I thank each and every one of you, my beautiful listeners, for sharing this part of my life with me. So, without further ado, happy birthday to me! Before everything else, I wanted to thank each and every one of you for your good wishes, prayers, good vibes, etc., because of our recent COVID-19 emergency. I am happy to report that my son is pretty much fully, completely recovered. And I don't know if you remember, but I tweeted that the rest of the family, none of us tested positive, thank heavens. And it's been more than 20 days and no symptoms whatsoever. So I think that we dodged that big bullet. So again, thank you all for your words of encouragement and what can I tell you? Your friendship. As you know, the main event for today is the Ask Me Anything episode. I'm actually very relieved because of your questions. You were all very, very nice. But joke aside, I really like them all. We are going to talk a bit about science, a bit about culinary arts and maybe gastronomy. We will talk about parenting and we will talk about careers, among some other things. So, let's begin with some science first, and the very first question is from my friend, John. I'm gonna read it verbatim because I want to make a point first. Here goes. Good day, Professor. I do have a multi-part question. Well, John, before I answer the question, you and I go way back. We've been friends for a long time. So do me a favor. It's One. Anyway, here's his question. In COVID-19 infected individuals, is it true that the effects of the COVID-19 virus permanently alter human tissue after infection, i.e. brain tissue? Well, John, my answer as a non-virologist is a preliminary yes, a qualified yes. It's well described that the effects of COVID-19 go way beyond from its infection to the lungs themselves. Lingering effects of COVID-19 infection affect virtually every other organ system. And pertaining specifically to John's question, there are neurological effects as well, which brings us to the second part of his question. If COVID-19 infection affects the brain, how does it do the damage, since the blood-brain barrier is a line of defense for the brain? Well, John, thanks again for your questions. They are great ones. And as far as the second answer, we have to remember that the blood-brain barrier, it's a mechanism through which the brain prevents the entrance of substances in the bloodstream. Okay? Like when you get a toxin, things like that. In the case of viruses, though, it is my non-virologist speculation that it will not work because viruses infect cells, and the blood-brain barrier is made out of certain structures and specific features of the cells that line the blood vessels surrounding the brain. This is the best I can do, not being a virologist. But thanks again for the question. So, let's lighten up things a little bit and let's talk about food. I have three questions from my friend Eloisa, who charmingly calls me Professor One, and I love it. One of them pertains to foods, but not just any foods, desserts. Well, that specific question asks, what is your favorite dessert? Well, Eloisa, I will answer the question with one condition. Please do not tell or say anything related to my answer to my physician, my primary physician, to my cardiologist, or to my endocrinologist. There's a couple of digressions that I need to make in this regard. First, you will find that as you get older, you get more physicians. Second, my primary physician, my cardiologist, and my endocrinologist are women, the three of them. So my message to all the young women, girls out there, girls can do science, girls can do mathematics, girls can be doctors, right? And don't allow anyone, and I mean anyone, tell you otherwise. But as usual, I digress. Well, my favorite desserts. That's a hard question because I don't really have one. I have a few. If I had to choose, I'd choose three. Two of them are well known, and a third one, well, you'll see. I love carrot cake. I love pecan pie, and I love a heavenly dessert called tres leches cake, or three milks cake. Tres leches is a Latin American dessert, and just thinking about it raises my blood glucose level. I won't say anything else. I'll just put a link with a couple of recipes in the show notes. So, yeah. Okay, I'll stop thinking about it now. Yeah. Eloisa gave me two additional questions. One of them is, what do you teach and to who? Well, Eloisa, these days I teach two main courses. Biological sciences for non-majors, and that's exactly what it sounds like. And I get from freshmen to seniors, but of any and every possible major at the university. I get English majors, I get literature, philosophy, and I also get a fair number of nutrition students, nursing, and the like. The other course that I'm currently teaching is pharmacology, essentially, and that's an advanced majors course, and from time to time I also get nursing students and the odd, for example, psychology students. which can take it as an elective. I like all my courses and I like all my students, but pharmacology is my thing. That's what I formally trained for. And that's the thing that I feel much more confident to teach. Eloisa's third question is, what's your favorite Puerto Rican place or city? Well, it's a little hard to me to choose a specific place in Puerto Rico that I like the most, but it would be whatever my family is. And in terms of touristy attractions, there's something called paradores. And they are not exactly hotels, but they are a little bit like bed and breakfast places. And there are many beautiful ones throughout the island. Some of them are at the beaches. Some of them are at the center of the island and well, everything in between. But they're really beautiful places, relaxing places. I recommend any and every one of them, as far as I remember. Okay. Well, thank you, Eloisa, for your questions, and let's go to the next ones. Okay, the next two questions come from my friend Kate, and one of them is career-related, and the other one is parenting-related. Here they are. I really want to ask you about your experiences being a parent of a young adult with autism. Okay, what can I tell you about that? As you know very well, as any parent knows very well, raising kids is challenging. We have three, our daughter, Vanessa, our son, Reinaldo, who has autism, and Andy, the youngest one, who's the tallest one and, you know, smart-aleck. All right. They are all delightful. I mean, genetics, right? But joke aside, raising an autistic kid and later on an autistic young man presents its particular challenges. My son is very verbal, very affectionate, smart as a whip, scary smart, but he will get himself into situations that he's simply not equipped to handle appropriately. Just to give you an example, he will walk into traffic without giving it a second thought. And as you can imagine, we worry. We worry a lot. And we worry a lot for the time when, inevitably, we will not be around to help him out. And we are, of course, arranging for many things to be in place for when that moment arrives. I fantasize a lot about acquiring the ability to be with him throughout all his life. But again, that's something that's not realistic. And in fact, I wrote a science fiction story based on this desire of mine as a father of a young man with autism. It's called The Voice of the Heart, and it's about a father who has an autistic son, and just like any parent, any father, worries about what's going to happen when he's not around. He lives in a moment in time where technology and computer science will give him a unique solution that allows him to take care of his young man throughout his whole life. And a few things happen along the way. Kate, I realize that I really haven't answered your question thoroughly, but the thing is that, as I'm sure you experience, sometimes it's easier to talk about these things and sometimes it's a little more difficult. It just so happens that today is one of those, well, difficult days. And I apologize for not being thorough in my answer. But I look forward to future conversations about this all-important topic. Now, Kate's second question is about careers. What propelled you to become a scientist? Was it something you stumbled upon, or has it been your lifelong dream? Well, Kate, it's a little complicated. Well, not really. There was never, ever any doubt that I will end up doing something science-related. But at the beginning of my college career, my parents wanted me to go into medical school. And I thought I wanted to go into medical school as well. But the thing is that during college, I wasn't really interested in the medically oriented courses. For example, I was never interested at all, not even a little bit, on taking anatomy and physiology, microbiology, things like that. Go figure. I love biochemistry, I love genetics, I love evolution, and all those type of things. So, along the way, through a series of improbable events, I ended up in graduate school at 35, after getting married, starting having my kids, so my wife helped with that. And, well, I was a non-traditional student, and it's a tradition that I have kept, because sometimes I feel that I am a constitutive late bloomer, okay? I went back to school at 35 for my PhD. I started working, I started developing my lab. When I was about 47 or so, I decided to begin blogging. I published my first book, The First Brain, and it was only last August, a few months ago, when I began podcasting. Okay, so what can I tell you? By the time you listen to this podcast, I would have already turned 56, December the 30th, and I'm having the time of my life. I absolutely love science. I love talking to like-minded people in that sense, and I love sharing my fascination for science and everything related to it with anyone and everyone within earshot. So, Kate, thanks again for your questions. The last question is from my friend Loani, and it's a rather intriguing one. She actually asked me whether there's cases of serial killers in animal species, meaning animals that kill without any nutritional purpose whatsoever, just kill and that's it. And I can honestly say that I have never thought about this, not even a little bit, so thank you, this is very intriguing to me. Now, the short answer seems to be that not exactly, okay? It is very difficult to ascribe motivations to any types of animal behavior, with the obvious exceptions like behavior that leads to reproduction, food gathering, shelter, survival, in other words. That said, there's undeniable cases of, for example, wolves or coyotes, animals like that, that can get into a farm, for example, and they will kill chickens without eating them, or sheep, or, I don't know, cows, or whatever. Okay? And there's many anecdotal cases like that. However, I came across a different type of behavior that is a little more complex than a purposeless killing act. For example, African lions are the only social cat species that I'm aware of. And they have a very structured societal organization. Their prides are composed of one male and many females. Now, when a pride changes, you know, administration, okay, meaning that current lion is challenged by a rival and the rival wins, one of the very first acts of the new lion of the pride is to immediately kill all the cubs in the pride, in order to, for the females to get back in heat, and the male ensures that all the cubs are his. That's an evolutionary behavior that I mean, of course, it's horrifying, but it's an undeniable part of the evolutionary biology of African lions. So it seems to be that we humans have the dubious distinction of being the only organisms that we know of that kill in a calculated, premeditated way. This is a very interesting question. I'm going to give it some more thought, so stay tuned. So these are the questions for the AMA part of the podcast. Remember that I had a little book giveaway as part of this AMA section, and the way I was going to do it is that I was going to put like a poll on Twitter, and people were going to vote for their favorite question. And the prize was going to be a signed copy of my Strange Survivors. The thing is that of the four people who submitted questions, three of them already have Strange Survivors, and I know that for a fact. That means that you, Kate are the winner. I'll get in touch with you so I can send you the book. Well, now in the final part of this episode, I have a special treat for you. I have a kind of a short story based on planarians as one of the main characters that I wrote as an epilogue for my first book, The First Brain. In addition to a certain planarian, another one of the characters is a little girl. And, well, you'll see what happens. So, this is my New Year's present for you. Imagine a young girl in the present day, walking by a pond near Hobart, Tasmania, a heart-shaped island south of Australia. Let's say that her name is Vanessa. She has beautiful dark skin and the beautiful dark curly hair of her Aboriginal ancestors in Oceania. She is exploring, looking for bugs, rocks, and other interesting things, hoping to collect all those little treasures that are of the utmost importance, and rightly so, when you are a curious child. A small planarian wiggling in the water catches her eye. She's immediately fascinated by it. After all, what's not to like? The worm is cute with its triangular head and its permanently crossed eyes. What she doesn't know is that this specific worm has a distinguished history. This particular planarian came from the regeneration of an overlooked fragment of a worm that was eaten by a small fish about a month before. In turn, that worm that was mostly eaten by a fish came from yet another fragment that escaped the attention of a predatory insect. It is easy to imagine a long series of incredibly lucky worm fragments that were spared predation in an improbable but entirely possible chain of narrow escapes, stretching for more than 170 years in the past. At that time, the original worm, which was hatched from an egg, was observed by a young man. A man that history recorded that kept the curiosity of a child until the day he died. This young man happened to be taking a stroll by the same pond as the little girl will do many years later. His name was Charles Robert Darwin. It is fun to daydream that essentially the same worm was observed by both the little girl and Charles Darwin, separated in time by almost two centuries. Their shared curiosity and wonder about nature represent some of the best traits in human nature. We believe that this curiosity is the hallmark of true intelligence. There are many strategies that organisms use to survive and eventually reproduce, which is the name of the game in evolution. In our case, we have survived primarily because of our brain. Now, the brain of that tiny planarian tells its owner little more than to avoid light, to always swim against the current, to mate sometimes, and to eat at every possible opportunity. Their brains are so small that, as far as we know, it is not possible for them to wonder what they are or why they exist. However, that little planarian brain may well be one of our key tools to understand ourselves. You see, part of the history of our own brain includes a nervous system very much like that tiny worm's. Because of our brain, we do wonder who we are, why we are here, and further where we are going. By studying those tiny, tiny brains from those tiny, tiny worms, we hope to be able to understand ourselves a little better. I hope you enjoyed my little present. Actually, this story is entirely plausible. Charles Darwin did visit Hobart in 1836 during the voyage of the Beagle. As he did everywhere he went, he collected specimens of the fauna and flora of the island. In his notes, he does not mention collecting aquatic planarians, but he did record that he found specimens of a terrestrial planarian, which he named Planaria tasmanania, later reclassified as Tasmanoplana tasmanania. Furthermore, he conducted regeneration experiments on them. This organism has the distinction of being the only Tasmanian terrestrial animal discovered and named by Darwin himself. I would like to think that he also saw freshwater planarians in Hobart. Well, my beautiful listeners, thank you ever so much for being my listeners. Thank you for being in my life. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the podcast. Happy New Year. Stay healthy and safe. And I will see you in 2021. Bye-bye.